Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. 2 years ago, at age 48, Scott Weiland died. It was December 2015. Recently, I found some audio from a pretty interesting conversation I had with him back in 2007. I was reporting a sort of dual cover story. On the cover, it was the anniversary of Appetite for Destruction, and inside we had a story about that. And then, because I was interviewing a lot of the remaining members of Guns N' Roses, we also did a story on the new Velvet Revolver album, which was called Libertad and turned out to be the final Velvet Revolver album. I spent time with all the guys in that band, and that included Scott Weiland. And Weiland was in a really interesting place. He seemed, or told me, he was sober and was really friendly, open, and sometimes incredibly dark in these interviews. Looking back, listening to them, I was really impressed with him. And a lot of it is pretty chilling in light of his death. He talks a lot about his own drug use. He talks about his brother's fatal drug overdose and how he wouldn't want to be like him. He talks a lot about the future and what it'll be like to be an older rock star. And it kind of sent chills down my body. It's intense stuff. But I think it's also worth hearing. And I also think it's a really, for once, it was Scott really presenting himself really well. I think you get a really good sense of him as a person. And he actually is really likable. Although I did witness some interesting Scott Weiland behavior during the reporting of this story, including making the entire rest of Velvet Revolver wait for him for a full hour while he finished the Clint Eastwood movie Unforgiven in his dressing room. So that was some Weiland behavior. I think he also was like 6 or 7 hours late to his interview with me. But once he was there, super charming. Anyway, here is me and Scott Weiland in the middle of 2007.
I love that country thing at the end of the record.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, huh? It was just, we did this shoot with Jim Marshall at the Roxy. And so we're just kind of, we brought some acoustic guitars along with us. And we sat up on the drum riser, started sort of noodling around, and just kind of came up with that Don't Drop That Dime.
Right.
It's just kind of like a little phrase and sort of vamped on it. And it's one of those tunes where, you know, the chorus is just, it's the same riff as the verse, you know. And you're kind of saying it over and over, all this kind of in harmony. It's one of those cool kind of little ditties. I like those kind of things. Sort of lighten the mood of a record, you know.
It sounds on the record like super authentic. It sounds like one of the Byrds country albums.
Yeah, I love Graham Parsons. He's great. He's kind of one of my favorite sort of icons.
You ever want to do some stuff that's more
country?
Yeah,
well, that was my first genre of music that I fell in love with, because my father, my blood father, was still is a huge country music fan, Waylon Jennings and Johnny Cash and, just the real stuff. So in the 70s, when I'd spend the summers with him, I'd fly out from Cleveland, he had 8-track tapes, and I remember we'd go out camping and drive from the Bay Area up to Northern California and listen to Jerry Jeff Walker and, that stuff, and kind of fell in love with it as a kid. There's been some songs throughout my career that have kind of had little tinges of that, with STP. Like even Creep had sort of that country kind of feeling. It was definitely in a moody sort of way, but
I know what you mean, on the chorus maybe.
And the forward yesterday makes me want to stay.
Right.
What you say is real. Makes me want to stay. Living on the house. Guess I'm living on a mouse. Take time with a wooden hand. Cause I like to steal. And then on my next solo record, there's this song that I wrote about my dad, because we kind of lost touch since really from high school on until just in the last couple of years, called The Man I Didn't Know, which is definitely a sort of haunting Daniel Lanois-esque kind of country tune.
I saw a show actually. I really did. I saw it at when Lanois played with you. I remember you saw a show. I remember that. I was like, wow, we got him in the band.
Yeah, yeah. There were some great shows, and there were some shows where I think I was on another dimension. And but there were definitely a few that were pretty fucking cool. Then there were a few where I had to exit the stage and vomit in behind the amps.
Mine was Jones Beach, which I think probably was the day before.
Yeah, that was not the radio shows were not the greatest venues to see that band though. Not the greatest sort of this was a new band just sort of coming together and sort of feeling itself out I think a couple of our best shows were at places like the 930 Club and places like that.
Yeah. How distant does all that stuff feel to you?
It feels like a whole life away.
Yeah.
Actually. It's weird, I have, my kids and when I go on tour now, I live for those moments on stage, when I get completely release everything and sort of escape from what my entire life is about. But the rest of the time, for the most part, it's real difficult to be away from my kids, and my wife. Before, when I was, sort of trapped in that mode, all I was doing really was I was running from the responsibilities of just being a father and being a husband, and that's really what I wanted the most was to, is to finally be a man, but it was so hard to sort of take that step, begin that journey. I don't know. It was like, and I've said this before, but I felt like I was trapped in this eternal Peter Pan complex, and I really kind of think that being in a band, especially once you become a celebrity or whatever, that it sort of enables you to stay in that mode.
Sure. Yeah.
Not to accept responsibility for your actions and that, and if you're making money, for other people, why not?
Right.
Rock stars are, expected to fuck up in that, and which is cool. There's certain parts that I don't regret anything really I did, except for the emotional injury that I caused other people. That really came crashing through when my brother died. Seeing the reality and the finality of it all, and how crushed how crushed I was, and how crushed my mother and my father were. They had to deal with that on a on a daily basis. Just the fear of the potential fear of that happening to either one of us. For years, and my wife as well, thinking that at any time that could, happen to the father of children, But when that happened to my brother, it was, it all seemed horrifically real.
Hmm. Like it could have been you?
I always got kind of seen it. I always kind of felt that I was, unbreakable, like I was a cockroach or something, that I could outlive an atomic bomb. When I got the call that a friend of my brother's had found him dead, and then I had to come over there because the police were there, and I saw him lying on his bed. And I had to identify his body. And he had gone through, and lived through as many, the same sort of situations that I had. He'd gone through ODs, lived through ODs, been busted and made it through numerous arrests without going to prison. And there it was. It was final. So you can't get any more real than that. We hung together always. Before we started using, then while we were using, and then for the last 4 years, once I kind of started getting clean, and he started struggling, I kind of distanced myself, and he really tried to hang with me, but I had a hard time understanding why he, and it sounds judgmental, but with everything he was facing, legally, and the divorce with his wife that she was going through, which was the same situation that I was in at the time when I ended up kicking drugs, why he couldn't kind of get it together. So it put a wedge between us. The last month before he died, we ended up fixing our relationship and hanging out again. He was with me all through Christmas time, and then, and since then, which was always kind of his wish, is like, why can't our kids be closer? And now they have, and I've set up a trust for them, and done a benefit for them, and intend to do more. As they, they're not quite on the same, quite as fortunate, right. Do everything I can to help them, the education and whatever I can do. It's probably definitely the heaviest thing that's ever happened to me in my life. I mean, I've never, besides my grandmother dying, she had lived a full life. I've never lost anyone close to me before.
So you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now. I'm Brian Hyatt, and that's me and the late Scott Weiland talking in the year 2007. We'll be right back with a lot more from that conversation.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
We've been playing some unearthed 2007 audio from my conversation with Scott Weiland just before the release of what turned out to be the final Velvet Revolver album, Libertad. And it's a pretty interesting conversation. Here's more from it.
You said that you can't really imagine doing this in a few more years. Is that really how you feel, that you're kind of done with the whole stage rocking, touring thing at this point?
Well, what I can't imagine doing is... I can't imagine doing what, Steven Tyler does, or Mick Jagger does, or, I can't imagine being in my 40s and, shaking my ass on stage and trying to pretend like I'm something that I'm not anymore. I feel like that part of this rock and roll journey is nearing its end, and it's coming time for the next phase. I'll always make records, because that's what this is about for me. It's writing songs and making records. It's that's what I get off on the most. You know, I mean, that's where the art is. So my studio, which I've had for 9 years, is a place that I, it's, I mean, I would do it if I didn't make money. You know, it would be a hobby.
Right.
You know, but I go there and I write and I record songs and I experiment, and I would love to just be able to be in that place where I could write the kind of music that I want to write without having to worry about selling 3-4 million records and right. recouping right. and all that, you know, and I'd love to be able to tour without having to worry about filling arenas and sheds and that, you know. It's been 17 years now of that, and that kind of wears on you, you yeah. know. It's a lot of stress, and I would just like to make music and put out records and tour when I'd like to tour, and if I, you know, play theaters and, you know, do, you know, in certain cities, do, you know, 2-3-4 nights or something, you know, if that was what happened, and that's, you know, kind of how I see things, you know. And
so why are you still doing this now?
You know why? Because right now it's still fun. Right now it's still fun. There's still this thing that I get out of that gang-like camaraderie, that dysfunctional camaraderie of being in a rock and roll band. You know, knowing that anything can happen at any time, I guess. And, you know, it's a lot of stress. You know, but, it's definitely not for the weak-hearted, you know. But it's also a young man's game, too, you know. The problem is that not many people can do it for a career. You know, there's, I don't think it's made, I don't think that, unfortunately, I don't think rock and roll is a career sport any longer.
Hmm.
It doesn't seem to be. I mean, the last band that has come out that, in the last few years that seems to be, to really have a career that comes to mind is the White Stripes, really.
Sure, yeah.
You know? Yeah. It seems to be on the path of having some sort of legendary status at right. some point.
Most like I was looking on the wall in your studio and you have, you know, a plaque with 6 platinum records. Nobody really nobody gets a plaque with 6 platinum records anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of impossible yeah. in the information age, you know what I mean? Kids download records these days, and, you know, I mean, it's understandable. It's a lot easier.
Yeah.
You know, it takes effort to go down to the record store, you know, and it's so much easier because everyone has a fucking computer. It's... I mean, I was really pissed off about it when it all started happening. And I felt betrayed, people stealing music, but it makes so much sense, you know. It's, you can't really fight something that just is.
The song "Spit" on the record, is that about Axl Rose?
No, not at all. No, definitely not. It's it's really about the it's really about a combination of this current sort of youth generation and the their idols, the celebrities, and the media, and its infatuation with celebrity. All of them all rolled into one, really. It's like, where does the problem lie? Is it, does it lie in the media sensationalism, or does it lie in the public's appetite for it, you know? And so the whole idea was, you know, just fucking spay them all, you know, so they don't just fucking proliferate the entire world any longer, you know.
So when you you posted that thing on the website of calling out that dude, you fat Botox, whatever, fuck, I mean.
Well, you know, the reason why that happened was he and I forget how the whole thing came about, but he had
that lawsuit where he.
Well, he had said some things about me first, and, you know, it was, I probably should have been more gracious and just left it alone, but I retaliated, and it, I guess, got out of hand, and I actually ended up hearing, because Matt ran into him at a club, Matt said his feelings were hurt by what I said, and then I felt really bad.
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh, but
yeah,
it's probably the fat thing. It's a bummer. Do you? I mean, you know, not physically, but do you see any of yourself in that guy? I mean, he's all. He
well, you know what I. You know what I do see is the. The inability to maybe control my temper at times, you know, I've been known to sort of go on rampages. On stage, if something sets me off, I don't really have a great control valve. You know, it when I blow a head gasket, it's hard to.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How you doing?
We're ready for you.
Are you?
Thank
it's
you.
Hard to once I blow a head gasket, it's hard to sort of contain myself. Yeah. You know, I don't have a great self container.
Right.
You know, so, you know, I see. That and but you know what, ultimately, to tell you the truth, I think that you know what, early in his career, I think that he was really on to something remarkable.
Yeah.
You know, I think that from what I know of the guy, and I don't know him personally.
Sure. Yeah.
From what I know of him, from various, obviously, I play in a band with guys that. You know, knew him very well for a period of time. You know, certain people become very successful allow outside people to manipulate them, you know, and that becomes their downfall, you know. If you are not in control in a sense of your own destiny and you don't allow yourself to think freely and make your own decisions, then no matter how talented you are or smart you are, you're going to, you're going to change, and you're going to start thinking the way other people want you to think. And I think it seems to me that that's sort of what happened to him.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, we've never been introduced, but just as... That's my, as far as from what I've sort of heard, that's my little take on the situation. But as far as a a fan of the old music, and a fan, definitely.
Yeah.
A fan of what he did.
You had said that new metal had kind of like turned you off rock and roll almost like a few years back.
Yeah.
I don't think you were far from alone in that sentiment. That was a hard time to...
Yeah, definitely. I think, rock and roll had lost its sexuality and its swagger, you know, and there was no melody, there were no chord changes, there was no singing, there was no blues in the music. It wasn't rock and roll, it was, you know, it was all rock, no roll,
right.
You know. I think there should be sexuality in rock and roll. Rock and roll is sex and drugs and violence and everything that is wrapped up in between. But I think that, I don't know. I remember we were touring one time with STP, and there was something on... someone had this video where there was something on one of the stations that had something about some new metal bands and the connection with porn, and there were some guys throwing lunch meat at
right.
at some these girls' ass in a dressing room, and it kind of that sort of just summed it all up for me, and I already just was basically over it completely. Especially coming from that time in the early 90s when there was such great music coming out, and it really was like a little mini revolution that happened. And I really believe it sort of revolutionized the way things were happening for a while there,
Know.
And, people started thinking differently and acting differently. It revolutionized the music industry. And, for a while, you could make any kind of video you wanted and any kind of record you wanted, and artists really had control. And unfortunately, it was very brief,
It wasn't cool to fucking throw lunch meat at women.
No, it wasn't.
It was really uncool at that point.
Yeah, and, it seemed like everything was kind of possible for a while.
How many more Velvet Revolver albums do you think there'll be?
I never know. That's hard to say, man. Right now, just focusing on, every show, just fucking offering... I fucking do every show, completely give myself up 100%. I do not back down.
Right.
I have scars all up and down my arms. And my back from just falling down and blooding myself because I just that's what I do. I'm gonna be 40 this year. I still perform the same way I did when I was 23.
Yeah.
When I went on our first tour with STP. I would definitely, there'll be another record, because by the time you're done touring, you just want to get back in the studio and you feel like you have something new to say, bottom line, you feel like you've reinterpreted all of the music, that you just recorded, every way that you possibly can, and you feel like telling a new story.
This is like the first record you made sober since forever, since ever, or since like the first couple SDP albums? Or?
No, I've never. I've never. I drink a little bit, but I don't do any drugs.
Yeah.
I've never made any record completely sober.
But I don't do any drugs. I don't do any drugs at all. I wish I could smoke weed, but weed is just way too hardcore for me. Mm. I've never been not since I was in high school, if I fucking enjoyed weed. Mm. If I fucking smoke weed, man, I fucking climb into a ball. Huh. It makes me think way too much, and thinking too much just gets me in trouble.
It seems to... It has really different...
effects on different people.
Yeah,
I get really paranoid. Mm. Shit. What was that last question, anyway?
Weed. Oh, right, so you did this record drug-free, and so was it...
Yeah, so the last record I did drug-free was Core.
Wow.
Yep.
So did it make it harder in any way, or was it...
No, it made it a lot easier. My output level was enormous. It was idea after idea after idea. The problem with heroin is that it's at first, it really sort of there's a lot of benefits. I think it allows you a certain amount of objectivity at first, like cerebral objectivity, because it kind of distances you somewhat emotionally. Mm. So you're not just so overly emotional to what it is you're writing about. So you can take some more chances.
Right.
On a intellectual level, like artistically, kind of say, I'm gonna risk this.
Right.
And get a little bit more out there.
Right.
But the problem is, though, is after a while, it becomes just overly cerebral.
Right.
Overly intellectual. Mm. And just, you can't, you lose the connection to the heart, to the emotion. And that's what I found. Mm. And it takes longer and longer and longer to just paint over, the music and the lyrics and the melodies, to try to grasp hold of some sort of emotional contact to what it is that you're writing about. And and you can just stay out there in space forever and write a bunch of non-linear bullshit, but you can't really hunker down into what matters and what you're really feeling, because you can't feel anything. It's like you have this narcotic wet blanket wrapped around your soul.
What about coke? What did that do?
Just makes you want more coke.
Yeah.
That's why I always had to do heroin, with coke. Fucking do coke for like a few hours straight, and then until you're going out of your mind, and the fucking demons are like trying to smash through the mirror. And then after that, it's time to run down the hallway and get into the fucking bag as soon as you can. Fucking put that fucking needle in the arm and get that shit in you quick to fucking...
No more demons, yeah.
You can fucking slow the fucking world back down and close up that fucking hole to the next dimension.
Jesus.
Because once you open it, it's you don't know what can come in.
Can you be the same after all that? All those experiences must stay with you and shape you, I guess.
Oh yeah, I think they probably do. Yeah, I think they probably do. But it's funny because the further you are away from it, like the less it even sort of crosses into your mind,
Yeah.
It sort of doesn't. I don't really think of it all that often. I'm sure that it definitely changes. I can't imagine who I would be. I wonder what I would be. I wonder like what sort of a person I would be if I never lived through those experiences. I mean,
You said that you've, have you reconciled things with the DeLeo brothers at this point?
Yeah.
How did that happen? Where did it happen?
Well, actually happened, the first time I ran into them was when we were recording Contraband. You know, that was a little uncomfortable because they were in the same studio.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, we were at NRG and they were in the one of the rooms next to us. And later, Dean, you know, Dean and I used to, you know, Dean and I used to be rock and roll hell on wheels together, you know. We used to get loaded together a lot, and, but I was always, like, known as the guy that couldn't, you know, couldn't stop.
Right.
I was that guy.
Right.
I was the identified junkie, you know.
Right.
But, you know, after the band broke up, you know, I don't want to, I don't know what Dean says in his own interviews, and that's why I don't want to tell a story, but, you know, Dean came and, you know, Dean did his own stuff, took care of his own stuff, and he called me up one day and he apologized, he made amends to me, and since then, you know, we've been a lot closer, and we kind of buried our personal hatchet, and then you know, Robert and I, you know, we've done the same. You know, we've seen each other a few times, and I've seen Eric a few times. We actually all went to Eric's wedding, and you know, the whole band was together there.
Anyone try to get you on stage or anything at that thing?
No, but I was tempted to go down to see their new band play when I was in New York. We were really busy. I actually really wanted to go down there, and it was I remember one time when they were playing with Talk Show. I went to see them play at the Palladium, and they wanted me to come on stage. But I felt sort of weird about that, you know. I felt like this was their thing, and you know, I didn't want to step on the toes of their singer, you know. Felt it would be kind of rude.
Yeah.
You know, I would feel very uncomfortable, you know, and it could be fucked up if Axl Rose came to watch our show and he came on and sang one of a Guns N' Roses song, you know. So I, I'll watch.
Yeah.
You know. I guess they broke up, that band.
I sort of heard that, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know what's going on musically with those guys now. But I'll tell you, they're amazing musicians.
Yeah.
They're fucking amazing musicians. I think Dean's one of the most underrated guitar players of, you know, the last, of the whole last decade and a half. I think he's amazing.
Is it different to write songs with Velvet Revolver compared to Stone Temple Pilots? I mean, what's the...
Well...
The chords they come are different, but I mean...
Chords that come... You know, I'll tell you, the thing... The one difference is STP loved being in the studio. You know, there was this element of STP that was much more like the Beatles. I mean, no band's like the Beatles.
Sure.
It's like, it's just blasphemy for any band to really, I think, to mention themselves in the same breath as the Beatles. But where a band loved being in the studio and you know, kind of just tripping out and exploring things and really taking risks and, you know, from one record to the next and just, you know... And I think, left to our own devices, we would have went anywhere. You know,
yeah.
It was, Brendan would say, oh, like, harness us, and like,
yeah.
You know, hold on, you know. Now, Velvet Revolver, you know, really is kind of a Nuts and Bolts rock and roll band, you know, kind of because what who the players are, you know, it's like what you see is what you get, you know. We're not trying to fool you with trickery, you know. It's like blues based rock and roll, and we're just gonna kind of come out and like, you know, shove it down your throat, and that's really what it's about. Both bands are completely different. These guys really like to jam, you know, and they love to get in the room and they love to play. SDP hated rehearsing. We would go before a world tour, a, you know, 3-month U.S. arena tour, we would show up 2 days before.
Yeah.
Go over our set, you know, and, you know, get on a plane and whoosh, go to our first gig. Buses would be waiting and we'd roll.
Yeah.
That's how we did things.
Do you like the fact that these guys like jamming, or does it get a little...
I don't like to rehearse that much. You know, if we're learning new songs from the new record, then it you got to do it, you know.
Right.
One of my biggest influences of all time and my favorite singers and my favorite band are the Doors. There's not one harmony on on any Doors song anywhere, you know.
That's a good point.
You know, it's one voice and it just... one point of view, you know, vocally. It's like, you know, it's just blues. So, you know, I like that. I like that a lot. And that's a fine art, you know. And it's also improvisational. Improvisation is a fucking fine art. I mean, but it's a moment thing, you know. It's like you got to be in the moment to be able to pull that off. You know, you can't learn. You can't really learn blues, and you know. And it's like sometimes live we'll go off on. That's what this band will do. That, you know, go off on a little blues thing and just kind of vamp out on it. And sometimes you know, it's like if you really feel like you can pull it off, you just wail into it. And but it takes some fucking cojones to be able to step out there and to do it, because there are some times when you kind of take that step out there and it starts to not happen.
Yeah,
you know, and it's risky, you know.
Yeah,
that's what the whole jamming thing is about. But when it pays off and when it's good, it's good.
You mentioned like mini dramas with Slash, and then you also said somewhere else that like you guys had to have a bunch of fights and figure out what how to be a band. I mean, what are the points of contention if you're having mini dramas? Like, what's the...
Well, I mean, the problem is that everyone wants to be right, you know, and that, you know, everyone... wants to be there's a lot of big egos, you know. You know, everyone thinks that they have the history and the lineage to be, you know, a shot caller. And the problem is when everyone does that, then we really get nowhere.
Yeah.
You know? And things get really confusing and really fucking just fucking bumbled and jumbled really fast. And there's a lot of different interpretations and a whole lot of misinformation that happens. And it was actually easier on the first record because it kind of but with the success of the first record, I think that you know, that everyone in the band has started to think that, you know, I want to make sure I get my voice heard, you know, and that, but the problem is, the thing that really works is when we have a band meeting and everyone just decides things together, you know, yeah. And everyone gets their voice heard in that, but when we're not communicating like that, and everyone tries to just make decisions, it doesn't so much work out all that well. You know, there's usually sort of there's a way that things have worked, and there's a way that things don't sort of work.
Right.
But,
so how do you get past it?
What's that?
How do you get past all that?
Well, you just, go with the fucking, the bumps and the bruises until, you learn the hard way, and people learn the hard way.
I mean, you're kind of like the, you know, not only were three of the guys in a previous band together, but the fourth knew the other guys longer. I mean, does that make you sort of the...
I'm kind of the one that sort of comes up with a lot of the creative ideas. And that's kind of like who I've always been, you know, ideas for video concepts and... record cover ideas and marketing ideas and just that creative sort of idea guy. And then I'm not that guy that's gonna go over pour over budgets. Right. I've never been that guy.
Right.
You know, I'm like the guy that's the conceptual guy.
Right.
You know. And when things sort of rock that balance, then it kind of,
yeah,
the whole boat kind of gets rocked.
Well, it sounded like, but tell me, what's that medallion around your neck, or the silver one?
Which one, this? This is Mary the Virgin. And this is Archangel Michael.
Are you? Do you go to church?
Yeah, I'm Catholic.
Yeah. And you said you go and do confession. Or
as little as possible.
This has been today's Rolling Stone Music Now. We'll be back next week here on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106. And in the meantime, you can download us as a podcast, subscribe to us as a podcast, give us some great reviews as a podcast, especially on iTunes. And we will see you next week. I'm Brian Hyatt, and this has been Rolling Stone Music Now.